nothing of importance happened today. So read an entry in the diary of a Parisian cobbler, Jean Lenoir. The entry was dated July the 14th, 1789, just over 200 years ago. Only a few streets away, of course, that same day, the French Revolution had been touched off as an enraged mob stormed the infamous Bastille, razing it to the ground and freeing its prisoners. But in the opinion of an oblivious Frenchman, nothing of importance happened today. So it must have been with numbers of people the day Jesus Christ was executed. To many, it was another day at the office. Some people didn't even know it was happening. Very few who were there understood the enormous significance of something that was going to change the history of the world, your history and mine. The longest day, we're calling this little study. We've already read Luke chapter 23, the description by that Gentile man, Luke, of Christ's death upon the cross. I'd like to go back a few pages, in fact, in Luke's Gospel, by way of interpretation of the Gospel, to chapter 2, verse 34, to try and understand what was happening there in Luke 23. Verse 34. It's Simeon's words in Luke chapter 2 there. He says, "Behold, this child is set for the fall and rising of many." The words of Simeon, the old man who had been waiting devoutly for many, many years for Israel's Messiah. And then in a flash of divinely given intuition, he recognizes in the infant Jesus, as he holds him up, whose parents had brought him to the temple, the long-awaited Christ, the deliverer, the king person. And holding that baby, that's what he says, "Behold, this child is set for the fall and rising of many in Israel." It was a prediction that history has shown to be startlingly accurate. Whole civilizations have been affected by the acceptance or rejection by individuals and groups of people of the world's pivotal figure. It's very important what we've been reading about. C.S. Lewis has said, "Christianity, if false, is of no importance, and if true, of infinite importance. The one thing it cannot be is moderately important." And it is because Christ is who he is that our decisions about him become the most important decision that we will ever make. I don't know what you would describe, how you would describe your own relationship to Jesus Christ. It's not enough quite to say, "Have you got a relationship to Jesus Christ?" but rather to pin us down further and say, "Describe your relationship to Jesus Christ." Or, said somebody once to a minister that I know, "I don't believe that Jesus Christ ever existed." Well, he said, "What do you make of the evidence of these documents in the Gospels?" Okay, in the reply, "His disciples made that up." He said, "Who? Whose disciples?" "Christ's disciples." Then the person had to stop and think again. If there are disciples, who are they following? A man said to me out in the entrance there earlier in the summer, "What about all these things we read, you know, about the things that Jesus Christ is supposed to have said? Perhaps they were forged." So I said to him, "Supposing that they had been made up by somebody. Somebody said them. Somebody said the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Somebody said, let the little children come to me and do not forbid them, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. Somebody said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Somebody said, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Somebody said those things, I said, because they actually stare us in the face out of the pages of these fascinating documents. And I said, whoever said those things was a giant. So if it wasn't Jesus, I want to follow the person who did say those things. And who was this person? Why, he is a person who would forgive the sins of people. In a monotheistic society, that was unheard of. He accepted the worship of people, so that people would say, who is this person who forgives sins? Who is this person who accepts the worship of others? Who is this person who stills the storm? Who is this person who claims that he will be the judge of the whole earth? Who is this person who claims to be the embodiment of all truth? Not to teach the truth, but to be the truth. So we have to make up our minds about Jesus Christ, and he will haunt us forever. He will pop up again and again through books, cinema, conversations, music, art. Again and again he will be coming at us. His voice still speaks across the centuries, speaks today. And truth has a strange, sharp cutting edge. Christ's own life on earth illustrated this. As he entered into our situation, why, he is the universal reference point for us all. Nevertheless, he divides people, nations, societies. And as we look at our text there in Luke 2, 34, and read on towards the culmination of the story at chapter 23, the story of the cross, we can see how that our dispensations divide at Christ. Maybe that's my initial point I can register here. Our dispensations divide at Christ, by which I mean our eras, our epochs. Certain linchpin dates and events seem to mark out and distinguish one epoch from another. The Great Fire of London, 1666, people tend to know that, was one such landmark in this city of ours. People talk of pre-war and post-war, because of course World War II left its mark upon the whole of Europe. Or sometimes the very old-fashioned among us get called antediluvian, because we seem to date from before the flood. But then the great dividing line is the life, the ministry, the saving death of Jesus Christ. And as we look back to that event, we can recognize an eternity of difference between the old dispensation, the old arrangement, and the new. B.C. and A.D., they're very, very different. So Simeon, back in chapter 2, when he said, this child is set for the fall and rising of many, he really belonged to the old order, to the Old Testament, where sacrifices had to be made in order that the sins of God's people could be dealt with, at least symbolically. All that changed after Christ. The death of Christ marked the parting of the ways. And the world could never really be the same again. Here was at least a claim that God in human form suffered and died and in so doing accepted the guilt of a whole world that was in the flames of rebellion against him. And that it happened one Friday just outside Jerusalem in a terrible event. Cicero said at that time about crucifixion, it is the most cruel and shameful of all punishments. Let it never come near the body of a Roman citizen, nay, neither near his thoughts or eyes or ears. The long day. It began very early for Pontius Pilate. He was roused from his bed at dawn by a large crowd of respectable religious people demanding a trial for a prisoner accused of setting himself up as a king. The rest of the day was to see Pilate struggling to avoid making a decision about this man. Little did he know as he woke up that morning that this day, this Friday, the longest in his life, was to turn him from being an unknown Roman procurator of an insignificant imperial province into the second best known name in the history of the human race. His name would feature weekly on the lips of billions of people, as in hundreds of different languages, they would declare their belief in the creed, in Jesus Christ, and that historically he suffered under the only other name that comes in the creed. He suffered under Pontius Pilate. So Pilate is named Sunday after Sunday after Sunday around the world, the second best known name in the world. He didn't know that. Our dispensations, BC and AD, they divide at Christ. And this long, lonely day was the reason for it ever happening. Our dispensations divide at Christ. But also, our dispositions divide at Christ. Our attitudes, they divide right there at Jesus Christ. His death has provoked and disturbed the world as no other death in history. The attitudes of people towards good and evil become sharpened, highlighted through this death. Some turning towards him in faith and loyalty, love and gratitude. Others turning their backs on him in bitterness and rejection. It's a very strange phenomenon. The same sun that melts the butter hardens the clay. So, could you describe your relationship to Jesus Christ? Christ's death reveals us as we really are and even emphasizes the direction that our lives are taking. As we look at the cross, it pins us down. They thought that they had pinned him down. But in fact, as history has unfolded, we find that in the very act of trying to pin him down, they gave him to the world. Now he pins us down. His death, followed by the remarkable resurrection, is forever. So that picture behind me on the wall there, donated to this church by King George IV, painted by Richard Westall, is entitled, Behold the Man. And we see there Jesus Christ, his hands bound, and other hands around his head, threatening. Hands of enmity. Hands of accusation. Hands of mockery. In fact, today, it's Christ, the living Christ, who confronts us. All power is given to him. And he woos us and wants to win us with the cords of love to himself. It's not a manipulating love. It's a sacrificial, dying love. And he says, come to me. I'll forgive you. I will love you. I do love you. The proof is in the fact that I died for you. And when somebody is able to say that, he died for me, he has lifted the burden of my own guilt off me, he's established a relationship between me and the Father in heaven, then we can begin to say, I think I'm in the position of being able to describe my relationship to Jesus Christ. For some people, the message of Christ crucified and risen leads to their being elevated and forgiven, received into the family of believers worldwide. For others, it signifies disaster, frustration, and ultimately the hand of judgment. It depends how we identify with the cross. So if we're like Joseph of Arimathea, who very late in the day, but nevertheless in time, decided that he would go to Pilate and ask for the body of Jesus so that he could place the body in his own rock-hewn tomb. He was identifying and saying, I care, I love, I believe. Pilate's strange, silent prisoner had this effect upon the Roman procurator. We know about Pilate from the Roman historian Tacitus and the Jewish historian Josephus. Pilate became the fifth procurator of Judea in the year 26 AD. He was very unpopular with the Jews, with his reputation for scandals and for executions. He was desperate to stay in the good favor of the emperor Tiberius. That meant keeping the peace in Judea and particularly in Jerusalem. And a Passover time was the particular time to keep a wary eye open. So on this particular day, with the Passover rapidly approaching, we see Pilate haunted by that decision that he had to make. about this prisoner. On one side was the crowd, crying out for the death of the carpenter preacher. On the other was Pilate's own wife, who got word to him during the day that he should have nothing to do with what she called this just man, because she'd suffered terribly in a nightmare about him. On a third front, there was all-conquering, all-powerful Rome. And here is Pilate struggling with his conscience. He knows what is right. He knows that the man is innocent. And the attempt to get Jesus off the hook is made as he sends the prisoner to Herod. But then to Herod, the whole thing is one great big yawn. Herod lived from moment to moment, the front seat at everything, always getting the best tickets. And if he could be entertained by this, then send the prisoner along. The prisoner kept silent. No entertainment. Herod was bored to bits and let the whole thing go past him. He got left completely behind on the high roads of history. And Pontius Pilate tries to ensure that the release of Jesus as a Passover concession to the Jews, which was customary at that time. Who shall we release? You can choose. And he says, perhaps you would like to have Jesus released. But the ringleaders have already got two steps ahead of Pilate and have sown the name of Barabbas already among the crowd. And the crowd is ready, not this man, but Barabbas, the murderer. Let's have him released. Pilate then has Jesus beaten, thinking, maybe that will be enough. If we can have him beaten and let him go, that will satisfy the crowd. But the crowd are not satisfied with that. Only Pilate, they know, has the power of life and death over a person in that province. So the decision is his. So we find Pilate saying, what shall I do, he says, with Jesus who is called the Christ, that they all come back, crucify him. You know what a crowd is like. If we'd have been there, we'd have been saying the same thing. It's just something about a crowd. And in the end, Pilate chooses not to choose. But to choose not to choose is to have chosen. And for 2,000 years, history has declared of Pontius Pilate, you chose. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate. So Pontius Pilate is the classic example of a principle surrounding Jesus Christ that is with us always and is with us tonight, now, here in All Souls. Christ has come, but the very light he brings divides people in their dispositions, in their attitudes towards the light. You could have said, oh, Pilate was so near, very near being among those who were the believers, very near in some ways. He knew what was right, but in fact, to be very near is still not to be there at all. So the priests and the religious leaders plot and blaspheme against Jesus. Pilate wobbles and finally takes the wrong turning. And this is what Christ does to people. The line comes right through a crowd. Anywhere you find a crowd, there will be some who believe in him, some who do not believe in him. Judas despairs, but Peter repents. Joseph of Arimathea finds new courage and asks for the body of Jesus so that he can give it a burial. Nicodemus comes by day now rather than by night. He gains fresh courage from the experience of the cross. Some soldiers gamble for Christ's clothes at the cross, but then the centurion who is around there reverences Jesus and says, this surely was a righteous man. One thief blasphemes. The other thief at Jesus' side prays. You can put two people side by side, both from similar backgrounds and cultures. It's no surprise, really, if one is disposed towards Jesus Christ and the other is not. I remember Mission 89 this summer. I was the chairman of it. And so I was there every night and had to be in a little room beforehand, meeting with one or two of friends who were specially invited. And I remember meeting two highly placed men, both doing the same thing in life. I introduced them to Dr. Graham, then took their seats, special reserved seats, sitting near each other. And then came, you know, you were there, you heard Billy's appeal. I'm going to ask you to get up out of your seats. Come forward in response to Jesus Christ. Come and stand at the front. Both men got up out of their seats. One to go forward with tears pouring down his face. And the other to light a cigarette. Well, that's the way it happens. It's a very simple thing in the end to choose life for Jesus Christ. Pilate had the whole day to choose. Oh, it was a long day. With different facets in the day. We see them there. We heard them there in Luke's Gospel. The different movements, the different trials going on. There were three different trials really taking place. Pilate had the whole day to choose and muffed it. The historians tell us that in AD 37 he eventually was ordered to report to Tiberius in person to answer accusations made by the Samaritans about him. And Pilate became replaced by Marcellus. On his way to Rome, Pilate's way to Rome, Tiberius died. We don't know the exact result of Pilate's trial, but Greek historians tell us that he was forced finally to commit suicide during the reign of Gaius. It's a strange thing that he had an encounter with the person who was being called the King of the Jews, the Christ, the person whom well over a billion people today meet in church to worship. The dying thief beside Jesus had no such prestigious position. He couldn't wield his power at all as Pilate could. He had no power to make any choices at all. It's doubtful if he could even really see the tired, dying figure beside him. So that the thief's life had narrowed down, right down, until there was no more choices to make. And that is the way that choices go. The older you get, the less room there is for choices. When you're young, you can make all sorts of choices. And talks about guidance that are given at the Bible class when you were at Sunday school. Very easy talks to give, because the field is wide open. But as you get older, the field of choice gets narrower, narrower, and narrower, and narrower, until in the end there are no more choices. So the dying thief on the cross, couldn't have been less ready. But he was ready enough to make that one last choice. Just one. It comes out as that tremendous, tremulous prayer. Remember me, Jesus, when you come into your kingdom. Well, you could pray a prayer like that. Many people have. People sometimes in prison have prayed a prayer like that. The soldiers who mocked Jesus Christ and dressed him as a king, why, for them, yes, it was another day at the office, really. They didn't know who they were crucifying, and Jesus realized that, and in that prayer, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. He expressed that reality. If you visit in Jerusalem today the convent of the Sisters of Zion, you must remember to go there. It's the best of all the sites to visit. The convent of the Sisters of Zion. They will take you below ground level to what archaeologists have established now as the very pavement where what was called the game of the king was played out by the soldiers with the unfortunate prisoners. You can see the scratchings. I've been there. You can see the scratchings that they drew on the pavement. One square on it is marked with the Greek letter B. B for Basileus, king. And the archaeologists say, yes, this is completely authentic. That's where they played the game of the king with the prisoners. So Jesus wasn't the only prisoner this game was played with. But of course the controversy about him being king of the Jews gave an extra twist to the proceedings. Then they take him to Calvary. Calvario, the Latin word. Golgotha, the Greek word, same place. There they crucify him. And we can't really understand what took place. We can only very dimly understand that in the Middle East it gets very hot. There are flies everywhere. So that to be in that predicament, dying, stripped, being gazed at by passers-by, with flies everywhere, and the torturing thirst above everything, something that nobody here in this room, none of us, knows anything about. It's Christians who say, we realize that it was God in Jesus Christ who was reconciling us to himself, not imputing our trespasses to us. He was lifting off us the guilt, lifting off us the sins, taking away from us voluntarily in his dying love the things that were otherwise going to take us to banishment and outer darkness and lostness. So the loneliest person in the whole world was Jesus. What does the cross do to you? It's when we realize that the cross has done something to us that we can say, begin to say, I'm on the way to describing my relationship with Jesus Christ. I remember being at a forestry project years ago when I was just a young fellow. I wasn't really a believer in Christ, though I had a Christian background, fine Christian parents. And I'd never honestly understood the cross. I'd sometimes ask my parents about it. Why was it that somebody who died, 2,000 years ago, why is it that I can be forgiven now, all that time later? They explained with great patience that the penny didn't drop. That night at the forestry project, which was run by Christian people, the penny dropped. The man was explaining. He said, let me describe, he said, from Isaiah chapter 53, and verse 6, and he said, all we like sheep, he said, this is a prophecy, he said, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, or her own way, as the case may be, and God has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And he said, suppose for a moment, he said, that this hand represents you, and that this other hand here represents Jesus Christ, that the light above there represents God the Father, and that this dark object, forgetting for a moment that it's a Bible, he said, supposing that represents the weight, the guilt of your sins that nothing you can do can remove. Now he said, look at it like this. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity, the sins of us all. And then the speaker looked at us all. There were about 120 of us in the room. He said, so where are your sins now, if you accept what Jesus has done for you? The penny began to drop. Then somebody said something about the boat race, how you find yourself represented. You identify with Oxford and Cambridge very often. You say, well, I like Oxford, or I like Cambridge. We won the boat race. You? You went in the boat? No, but I was there. I was there, in my mind. Well, that's what that songwriter says. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Yes, we were there. Representative man, Jesus Christ, dying for us there upon the cross. So as it was explained in that forestry project, I remember thinking, I want to be a Christian. I was too shy to tell anybody about it. I couldn't. If anyone asked me to declare myself or go forward like a Billy Graham, I couldn't. But that night, sitting up in bed as best I knew how, I asked that the shepherd, Christ, the good shepherd, would be my shepherd. I established a relationship of friendship with him then. The next day, I couldn't tell you that I felt particularly different, but I woke up and I thought, I have done something very, very important. Started properly with Christ. It's become personal. At last. I was so grateful. Still very shy. Couldn't tell anybody. Not for a long time. Then little bit by little bit I began to declare myself. See, one thing is plain. We will never get away from Christ's claim. In a thousand different ways his name will come before us. And if it isn't in a church, well, his name will come up in a book. Or in the words of the great artists and musicians of the world, and all the time, you are either moving closer to him or you're moving away from him. There was a coach driver, going back to Billy Graham, not at this crusade, this mission, but a further one, further back in London, And he was asked to take a whole bunch of people along to hear Billy Graham. He drove there, and the people in the coach said, "Well, come in with us then. Listen to the great man." "No, no," he said, "I'll just enjoy my cigarette and my paper." Several nights he came, and the same man, but each time they said, "Wouldn't you like to come in?" "No." "No, thank you." So then the mission was over, and then he lost his job, sadly. He was out of a job and became redundant, and in his desperation he went to Australia and found a job. They gave him a job as a coach driver again, and he said, "Well," he reported the first day, he said, "What's the first job?" "Well," he said, "they said Billy Graham's coming," and he asked to take a coach party to Billy Graham. And he went, and he stayed, and he found, and was changed. It's very wonderful when that happens. Our dispensations divide at Christ, our dispositions divide at Christ, and very last and briefly, our destinations divide at Christ. See, Luke 2:34, what does it say? "This child is set for the fall and rise of many." It's one or the other. We're either moving towards him or we're moving away from him. What is it to be? So I want to help those of us who are not sure where we stand in this matter, as I myself was not sure years ago. I want to help. The word "rise" is used consistently in the New Testament for references to the resurrection life, that kind of rising. The word "fall" means collapse. So what are we talking about? Well, the criterion, the factor that determines whether you and I will fall or rise lies in the issue as to what we do about Jesus Christ, his words, his claims, his love, his cross. We fall or rise according to what we do with his life-giving words, who died and who rose bodily, historically, from the grave on that third wonderful day. So don't be left behind. We don't want that to happen, as Herod was left behind, Pilate was left behind, many others. We help each other in this church in this respect. There's a mainspring in all of us, and we ought to bless that person who can touch the mainspring in our life and reveal it to us in the full recognition that the person who can touch it reaches us, rules us, leads us. Be that person a philosopher or a poet or a politician or a preacher. But then if that person is Jesus Christ, unique Messiah of God, then the way in which we react to his touching of our mainspring determines in the end how and where we're going to spend the whole of our future life and existence. Somebody says, "I can choose later. I can choose on my deathbed." I don't know whether you've seen people on their deathbeds. I've seen hundreds of people on their deathbeds. By the time you're on your deathbed, the likelihood is that you'll be pumped full of drugs so that you'll be in no position to make a decision about what you're going to have for breakfast or lunch, let alone how you're going to spend your future. We remember Pilate on his longest day. We remember the thief who was in the worst position of all to make a decision, but made a decision. Let's help one another tonight. Let me help you, you inquirer, after these matters, whoever you are. Why don't I stand here at the end afterwards? The other people, the other ministers go to the church entrance, just shake hands on the way down to the coffee. I think I'll stay here. Why don't I, well, I have already asked, I hand-picked a little team of five people who will stand with me. And what we're going to do is simply to hold my book that I wrote. It's called Making a Start. Nothing very pretentious about it, but it just explains a little bit of the practicalities of what we do, how do we come to establish a relationship with Christ. There's a prayer at the end on the last page, which you may want to make your own. You can take this little book from me. You're quite safe here. Nobody's going to pressurize you, or manipulate, or embarrass you. But we six people, will be standing here at the front. You don't have to come to me. I'm already talking to somebody. You just pick the person who looks the most friendly of the six and just say to them, "I'd like Richard Buse's book." And if you want to ask them a question about some group to join, please do. If you'd like to be on my little prayer list for this week, I'll pray for you every day. Let them have your name. And maybe your address, if you'd like me to write to you. I won't put it on a computer, but I'll just keep it by me and remember you, and then write to you. Just to help. That's the idea, really. Remember the thief. Remember Pilate. This child is set for the fall and rising of many. Christ affects our dispensations, dispositions, our destinations. And I'd rather be wrong. I'm not wrong, but I'd rather be wrong with the dying thief, with the centurion, with the scattered band of the disciples. I'd rather be wrong with St. Paul, Augustine, Dante, Milton, Michelangelo, Billy Graham. I'd rather be wrong with that crowd than be right with Pilate, Tiberius, Voltaire, Rousseau, the Huxleys, H.G. Wells, or Bertrand Russell. It's one or the other in the end, and it's the cross that is the catalyst for it, as to what we're going to do about it. It's either that there is God in Christ coming to us in love, or nothing of importance happened today.